I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking today with Bob Seidensticker. Bob is someone who's worked for many years in the fields of the high-tech industries. He's worked for Microsoft, and he'll tell us a little bit more about where he's worked. He's written software patents, and he's come out with a fascinating book called Future Hype, The Myths of Technology Change, which is just a wonderful corrective. It's a summary of many, many of the different kinds of arguments that need to be on the table for people who are techno-hyped. And we'll talk about some of those arguments in a second. But tell us, Bob, what exactly were the fields of technological endeavor that you labored in? And do you feel like this is your you're now an apostate from the techno field?
Well, I suppose it's to some extent. I initially started in digital hardware design. In fact, that's what my first book was about. Very narrow book, rather forgettable, I'm afraid. But digital design was just a great chance to be creative in electronics. I've been doing software since I was in high school back in the 70s, and that's kind of where I moved to fairly quickly, and writing on Windows version 1 all the way through version 3 at Microsoft, and then I sort of switched to being a program manager that is helping to design and manage the development of software projects. I was at Microsoft for about 8 years. Another company you might have heard of is IBM. I was there for a short time. And I've even been on the other extreme at startup companies. So I've been privileged enough to see a lot of the different variations in the electronics and computer industries.
Now, your book is about primarily the way that we all want to have what you call in the very first chapter the birthday present. We want technology to make everything better for us, and so we're very prone to falling for these technological hypes. But what's the problem with falling for that? How does it hurt us?
We can talk also about the some of the specific ways that we're deluded. But the real challenge, the real reason why this is not just an academic, that's interesting, but so what? The real so what is the cost that this puts us under. So if we feel that the carousel is spinning faster and faster, that technology is inevitable, that technology is exponential, we will act a certain way, and we'll often buy things on too little information. We'll not wait till these technologies mature enough to have them prove themselves. We'll just sort of take it on faith. I'm sure they will mature. I'm sure they will improve. I'm sure they are what they do have the value people say they do.
And when you say buy things, you're not just talking about particular products. You're talking about whole ways of life, entire changes in our society and culture.
Exactly, yes. From a consumer standpoint, it can be as little as one person going into one store looking at one product, an iPod or an HDTV or whatever. At the other extreme, we've got companies looking to adopt new technologies. For example, the companies that were sold on ISDN in, late 80s, early 90s, that sort of thing, might have made a wrong choice. They might have jumped on the bandwagon too much and were looking at this ISDN technology when the web came out and saying, maybe we backed the wrong horse here. So I think you're right. It really does span individual purchases by consumers all the way up to big technology adoption by companies and governments too.
So you talk here about the unintended consequences of these of the wager. What do you mean by that?
Well, so often we buy something, we anticipate technology will do one thing, and when we actually unwrap the package, sort of metaphorically, we see that maybe it didn't do what it was supposed to. Maybe it did the exact opposite. One example that comes to mind is this example of DDT in Borneo. It's a story from probably 50 years ago, but I think it was the World Health Organization, wanted to cure malaria in Borneo. So they sprayed DDT, and problem solved. The mosquitoes were dead, no more malaria, nicely done. But this very limited idea of the ecosystem, that is, DDT kills mosquitoes and they carry malaria, problem solved, was just way less than the actual ecosystem was. The DDT killed bugs that were eaten by the geckos. Geckos were now sick and were eaten by cats. No more cats meant rats. There were caterpillars that eat the thatch roofs. and the DDT had killed the wasps that prey on the caterpillars. So the bizarre consequence was that not only do you have less malaria, you have less roofs and more rats. So just a very naive understanding of what environment you're going into led to some pretty surprising, unexpected consequences.
Well, this is maybe a little bit off topic, but do you consider yourself a supporter then of what's called the precautionary principle, the notion that, you know, we have to understand what it's, if you just say it, it sounds like common sense. You have to understand what's going to be the consequences of your actions before you do them. But the way that the environmental movement sometimes interprets, just like the example you gave, is that you should never roll out something like DDT because we can never understand the consequences of our actions.
I think in general, I would not be a supporter. Just to sort of elaborate on this, there are cases where technology is obviously good. You really understand it well. No problem. Other cases where it's obviously bad, and you say, we understand that one too, we're not going to touch that one. And you have this enormous gray area. You have genetically modified foods, you have hormones in cattle, you have lots of things like this. And to take the precautionary principle to its extreme, it means you're just static. I mean, you say, no, that's not enough evidence, no, that's not enough evidence either, you're just never going to be convinced. And, you know, that is an attitude, it's sort of an Amish kind of approach perhaps. And I'm not saying that idea is bankrupt, and yet, personally, I think that we need to be a little bit more accommodating toward technology. Just to be clear, I'm not a Luddite myself. I love technology, but I love technology applied correctly. And it's when it's incorrectly applied, when we sort of apply it in a naive fashion, that's what really makes me annoyed.
The very first myth that you're out to bust in your book is this notion that change is exponential. And there's this new book out, The Singularity is Near by Ray Kurzweil, and he tries to marshal 10 to the 10th kinds of different evidence to make the case that technological innovation has been is exponential and will be exponential and will lead to some kind of techno-rapture in the very near future. And a lot of my friends are taken in by this, and it does create, as you point out in the book, it makes it almost impossible to talk about the different kinds of downsides that you point to, because there won't be any time to calculate any of those consequences, to stop this process of change, and to put anything better in its place.
Right, and then you have someone like Bill Joy, who's you know trying to pull the brake alarm in the technology train. But yes, my feeling is that the idea that technology is changing faster and faster cannot be supported by history. So he who knows what the future holds? I mean, we had, for example, the Industrial Revolution, which really did boost the rate of technology change. Maybe we have another one of those in the future. However, if you look at our history in the past 200 years, I say there is no evidence for this. And let me just elaborate on that. We could take airplanes, for example. We saw explosive growth in the early 1900s from biplanes all the way through jet airplanes, and it seemed obvious, of course, that supersonic planes would continue that progress. And yet the Concorde supersonic plane limped along until it was finally put out of service after, you know, maybe 25 years. And the irony is today we travel at the same speed as we did at the dawn of the jet age 50 years ago. So explosive growth for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, followed by a slowdown to maturity. We see that with airplanes, we saw that with skyscrapers, dams, other kinds of civil engineering, the printing press, electricity, telephones, and so on. Now we're seeing it with the PC and the internet. We are in the explosive growth period, the exponential period. But the point is that individual technologies can grow exponentially, but never technology in general. So if you look at the landscape of technology, you can imagine the spotlight or grow lamp, if you will, shining on just a couple of technologies, again, internet, PC, maybe cell phones, and this enormous landscape of super essential technologies is just sitting there, growing slowly, evolving nicely, but not growing exponentially. You know, this is electricity, printing, telephones, you know, really fundamental technologies, transportation, that sort of thing.
Kurzweil's argument, I think, would be to you that there's these S curves. That yes, there's a certain period at which things move very rapidly and then they plateau, and then another technology steps in and starts to move very rapidly and plateaus. And that what you've done is look back at these particular periods when things were moving very rapidly, but that these S curves mount along an exponential curve. And I think what you would say back to him, correct me if I'm wrong, is that he's being extremely selective in which fields of technological and social change he's examining, and he's only examining the ones that move fast in different periods of time.
You're right. That is what I would respond with. He makes a pretty compelling argument. In fact, in his book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, he didn't say that he invented this or he was the first to realize this, but the idea that Moore's Law, in quotes, sort of goes back all the way to, you know, roughly 1900. And if you look at, you know, mechanical, electromechanical tube and so on, you find a much longer progression of Moore's Law than just the 40 years. We celebrated the 40th anniversary, I think it was last year. Just the 40 years that Moore's Law has been in operation. But exactly that. I mean, he makes a pretty compelling case of this S-curve leapfrogging to the next S-curve to the next S-curve. So a couple of things I would say to that. That is in computing. Very impressive example. I'm quite impressed by that. And yet you look at civil engineering, you look at transportation, you look at energy. Just take an example. President Bush, in his State of the Union address in January, pointed out our dependence on energy. If only the energy industry was exponential, we would have a lot fewer problems. But you think of the things that are leading edge right now in the area of energy, the hydrogen economy. Fuel cells, on which this is based, were invented in 1839. Solar cells, the 1850s. The first car to exceed 60 miles an hour was a battery-powered car, 1899. Batteries themselves, 1799. On and on. So energy, unfortunately, is a very quiescent, slow-moving, sluggish technology. And of course, we have that example is in our face with our laptops. Moore's Law, every couple of years, doubling the power of the computer, and yet the battery is just sort of sitting there, making progress, no doubt about it, but it sure isn't exponential.
And Jaron Lanier points out that the software keeps up with the power of the computing in order to keep it down so that you never are able to do any word processing faster than you were with your very first PC that you got.
I've heard that. In fact, I've heard sort of a tongue-in-cheek law to sort of go along with Moore's Law is Andy and Bill's Law, and that is what Andy Grove giveth, Bill Gates taketh away. So we do have that challenge. And you know, here we are as consumers trying to harness Moore's Law, you know, every couple of years doubling. This is just such an amazing thing. And where's the beef? I mean, the challenge we have is if I replaced your computer, your PC, with one that was 100 times faster, would that make you 100 times more productive? Would it make you twice as productive? Would it make you twice as anything? And yet you can look at something as mundane as a dump truck. It carries a load of dirt, carries a load of lumber, whatever. You double the capacity of that vehicle, and the operator is now twice as productive.
Well, I did just get a new laptop, and I do feel more productive, but I don't know if I'd be 100 times more productive.
Right.
I'm talking to Bob Seidensticker, who's the author of Future Hype, The Myths of Technology Change. I'm Jay Hughes, and this is Change Surfer Radio. Now, I've never been enough of a historian of science to be able to mount a critique of the Kurzweilian analysis, but the thing that did always strike me about what he was talking about was that he and all of the techno, utopians that I know radically underestimate the diffusion of technology, you know, that just creating something on the lab bench. And since I'm an avid follower of the medical, medical science, I'm extremely aware of how long it takes from something to be discovered in a lab for it to ever, if ever, reach, the majority of people as a product and all the different steps that have to be taken. And you do a good job of pointing that out as well.
Yes, and in fact, the medical industry is one of the real winners in technology. So even the example you give of it's a bit of a challenge in medicine for a new technique, a new medicine, a new chemical of some sort, to actually make it into the hands of the patients that need it. Even there, it takes a long time. And the mouse first came out, I guess, with the Xerox Alto, Xerox Star. Invented in 1963. When you think back on VCRs, for example, we think of the early 80s with Beta and VHS, and yet the first tape recorders, first home or videotape recorders, were, I don't know, 20, 30 years prior to that. And in fact, we see that this the same trend over and over again. One of the things which frustrates me quite a bit is people talk about the collapse of the time from the light bulb over the inventor's head until it's a product in the marketplace. And one example they cite is the Internet. And one example I have in the book is this claim from the Commerce Department talking about radio to TV to the PC to the Internet, talking about this collapse of time. And they said, well, gee, if you think about when the Internet started, It was only just a few years before it reached, you know, a large fraction of the population, ignoring, of course, that it was the web they're talking about. The web started in 91. The Internet started in 1969. So the web was built on the Internet, which was rather old at the time, which in turn was built on the telephone system. So we definitely delude ourselves by imagining a quickening of technology.
So you mount a good critique of the press and the way that the press is collaborating in this. I mean, in medicine, we're extremely aware now of the way that researchers and pharma companies suppress negative results. Medical journals don't want to print papers that show null results. They only want to print papers that show positive results. And so there's a positive result bias in the medical literature. And we want to only read. We're only happy if we read about things going to be better in the future. We don't want to read about things being worse. Is there a way that you see for people to get a more balanced perspective on what's actually happening technology-wise?
You raise a very valid point about the press. And part of the challenge I think we need to do as consumers of technology, consumers of the information the press gives us also, is to see the press for what it is. And I think if we do that, we see it, you know, warts and all, we will be able to use the press as a very valuable tool. The goal of the press, in my opinion, is not to give us a Consumer Reports kind of, here is 10 choices, and I recommend this one, and we've done a thorough evaluation. They want to show what's new, what's exciting, what's entertaining. Different press media, of course, works different ways, of course, but again, if we understand that limitation, I think we can use them to great effect. The same thing is true for ads that come out of companies. Now, of course, those are, if we see them as biased information, that's terrific. Here's one company giving a pitch for what they have. That's terrific. They're not trying to can't claim we've, you know, done a Consumer Reports kind of evaluation. One other to sort of round out this conversation, one other challenge we have as seers of technology change is what I call technological myopia, and that's the very natural, very human tendency to see what's changing, what's aggravating us, what's delighting us, as being kind of all there is. So we dismiss what is distant in time, in this case, electricity, telephones, that sort of thing. It's in the background. We don't notice it. You know, talk about change. You know, who cares about electricity? This iPod is really cool, or the HDTV is awesome, or whatever. Ignoring the things that are just humming away. And actually, where I live, we every now and then get a power outage. A great way to really put in our face what's really important.
Let me just challenge you on the accelerating rate of change for a second. I mean, if you do look back at the emergence of Homo erectus, you know, and you take it forward from that perspective, you see all these timelines, you know, that, you know, for the majority of the history of the planet, there was no life, and then there was life, and the majority of the history of life, there was no intelligence, and then there was intelligence. The majority of the history of intelligence, there was no technology, then there was technology, and so on. And you look at something like the growth of population, it does seem like, you know, if you take a sufficiently distant perspective, there is acceleration. There may not have been any acceleration in the rate of technological innovation since 1500 or something, but certainly there are periods of history when you look at the emergence of agriculture until 1500, and that's one rate of change, and then 1500 on. And we might be entering in soon into something equivalent to the emergence of the Industrial Revolution or whatever happened in the Renaissance.
You're right. I can't really deny that. I think if you take that kind of view, you do see to some extent a quickening. At the same time, if you pick and choose, which I realize you're not trying to do here, if you do pick and choose, you can almost show the reverse. You say, well, you take take England or take Gaul during the time of the Romans, 2,000 years ago or so, things were pretty good, pottery, transportation, and so on. Then the Roman Empire collapsed, they pulled back, barbarians came in, things went backwards. So you have these aqueducts, these viaducts, these baths that the Romans built, you know, 2,000 years ago, roads also, still there, looking great, amazing, you know, shortly after that point, you know, the technology just went way down. So I think that to imagine a very nicely increasing curve is a little bit of a challenge. To pull things a little bit closer to the present, my personal feeling is that the rate of change hasn't changed much since the Industrial Revolution. So I see a real sea change about 200 years ago with the Industrial Revolution. Before that, yes, a lot less. After that, I think it's about the same, about a constant rate of change.
Are you a peak oil person? Do you think it's doom and gloom for the energy economy?
To some extent, I would love to see the government follow up on President Bush's challenge with this oil dependency. I mean, he makes a correct point there. I predict that it's not going to. We're still going to very slowly work forward on this. But I'm a bit worried about technology. And it's just a great example, again coming back to my point, of something which is just moving really slowly. And it's I think we need a Manhattan Project, an Apollo Project, to really get serious about whatever's next.
Your example of the Roman fall of the Roman Empire and the fall of Roman level technology, I think, is another good corrective, because most of the techno utopians I know don't take seriously the real possibility that we could have a civilization collapse, that we've become so fragile as a global techno civilization that something like a peak oil bust or a pandemic flu or something could, you know, break the whole thing down. I don't think personally, but I don't think they take that seriously. You know, what do you think of people like Bill Joy, who share some of the techno hype? They share the notion that we're going to quickly have upon us some really serious technological change, but they point out these apocalyptic risks.
Yeah, I actually, Bill Joy is he sees exponential change in a negative way. Kurzweil sees exponential change in a positive way, and my point is, I don't see the exponential change. So that's the, I guess, a difference there.
But that doesn't mean we have time to figure it all out. We still have these apocalyptic risks.
We do, and in fact, I think we can see even today the fragility of our technology infrastructure. Look at the satellites. Every now and then we have solar storms. So it's one of those things, like the electricity infrastructure, which again just sort of hums away in the background. All of a sudden, what happened? We have a blackout. The same kind of thing can be true in the satellite infrastructure. We have concerns about EMP or hackers affecting our nationwide information system. So we have a fairly fragile system. In fact, to turn the clock back, you know, 20, 30 years, one of the odd things about the Cold War was the Soviets had inferior technology, older technology. It was tube-based. And one of the concerns that the game players, you know, that the generals were thinking of was EMP as a way to destroy technology. Our electronics made us much more vulnerable to that. The Soviets, the older technology, was not so. And I think, not to make that into too big an example, but I think we see similar things in, as we get more sophisticated, more computerized, we become, to some extent, more vulnerable. The bank robber who went in with a gun and said, "Give me all your money," and he took as much as he could carry a limited amount. So the burden on the teller was the same burden on the bank robber. The burden on the teller now is minimal. You can transfer a dollar, you can transfer $1 million electronically. And the same thing is true for the electronic bank robber. He can go in there and transfer, if he can get in, money as easy as a bank teller can.
When people challenge me about the notion that we're entering into a transhuman or cyborgian period, I say, look, it started with written language, because that was the first time we were able to download thoughts out of our brain and actually use an external device as a cognitive enhancement. And you seem to go in a similar direction in your chapter, Technologies That Touch Us, about the importance of timekeeping and calendars and writing and the standardization of language and so forth as technological enhancements that profoundly change the nature of life. You want to say a little bit more about that and how that might change again in the future?
Yeah, good question. One example that I have in the book is Socrates' concern about language. He actually, to some extent, resisted it because he was concerned about the amazing memory skills, and which seems ridiculous on the face of it, and yet when you think about it, writing the Iliad or writing the Odyssey is only the words. All kinds of things aren't captured, the nuances, the pauses, the gestures, that sort of thing. So that was what he was concerned about, and I think we have similar concerns here with calculators. What if computers are able to offload us? You know, that's kind of good, but maybe that's kind of bad. So I think we can see, to some extent, some precursors to those kind of concerns in the past of what we're worried about right now. Bill Joy's concern of the gray goo to an extreme case, but to a more limited case, how much is good for computers offloading us?
There's a meeting in San Francisco 2 weeks ago on the Metaverse project where they're trying to build a meta virtuality platform. And a guy came to that meeting who was involved in international human rights work, and he was commenting on the fact that there's a Darfur education thing now in Second Life where people can learn about what's happening in Darfur. And he's saying, for Christ's sake, this is an environment in which only at a maximum a couple thousand people participate at any one time. If you're really concerned about educating the world about Darfur, don't educate the most techno uber geeks of the world, in this little environment. Go out and actually spread paper pamphlets or talk to your neighbors or something. I think there's a real point there.
Great point. Great point. In fact, you're probably aware of Nicholas Negroponte and the Media Lab and the $100 PC. Trying to use technology to do good in the third world. And I love the idea of the technology which is close to my heart, doing good at home in schools and far away in helping third world people. And yet I do question that. My concern is the scale he's talking about is pretty grand. He's talking about billions of dollars for these PCs and amazing products they are. And yet I wonder, is someone who doesn't have water, doesn't have clean water in his village, they have issues with malaria, measles perhaps, AIDS, these kind of things, is a PC what they really lack? Is that at the top of their list? Could that $100 be put to better use in some other way?
I don't know. I feel the same concerns about that, and yet at the same time, the idea of people who are the most disenfranchised in the world being able to have access to the internet and those computers themselves network and allow communication among each other, that does seem like an incredibly transformative and potentially radical idea.
It could be, and of course, the counterexample to what I just said is someone says, look at India. India 10, 20, 30 years ago wasn't doing so good, and yet we're concerned about being beaten in many areas by India, by smart Indian engineers. So could we do the Indian miracle in some parts of Africa, say, or Central Asia? And, again, I love the idea. I just hope that we're going to do this with our eyes open. So if we're really confident that if we do X, Y, and Z with computers, with internet cafes, in the third world, it's going to work because we've done it before in a small way, that's great. But let's, as we critique these things, a couple of good examples, a couple of anecdotes of, here's a kid who, here's what his situation before, here's where he is now, whatever. That to me is not especially meaningful. I want to see lots of kids transformed. And too often it's, the argument to increase, to ramp up production in a case like this is two or three anecdotes. That's it. I'd love to see bigger statistics of real change in a whole population, a whole village, a whole region, that sort of thing.
I think you're absolutely right. And there has been a real overhyping of the notion of leapfrogging in development economics. I don't know if it really takes them as far as they want to leap. I've been speaking to Bob Seidensticker, who's the author of Future Hype, The Myths of Technology Change. Bob, thanks so much for joining us. And you have a website, future-hype.com.
That's right, Jay.
And it's a wonderful companion piece to something like Kurzweil's The Singularity is Near or any of the other books in that genre, because it really raises all the questions both about the analysis of change and about the potential unintended consequences of change. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.